Testing, testing, testing. Can you hear me? This is Audible Autism.
Hello, everybody. This is Odai here speaking. Just giving an intro and a little bit of a warning to listeners here for the interview between Sarah and Rebecca Cavendar, in that there is a brief mention of suicide in the middle of the episode. The team discussed this about the logistics of whether this should be brought up or mentioned or if it should be edited out, but in the end we decided it would be best to stick with it as it is an important topic and something that shouldn't be shied away from. If you feel that this is something that is a bit too much for you, then wait until the next episode. But otherwise, this one I feel will be a worthwhile listen, and is certainly one of our stranger episodes. Otherwise, just wanted to let the listeners know, and enjoy.
Hello, and welcome to another episode of Audible Autism, Interesting Questions and Interesting Facts. I am your co-host, Sarah McCulloch. Odai is not available this episode. He is off recording with someone else today. But I have with me Rebecca Cavendar, who is an intuitive writer who's going to be speaking to us about her work today. Thank you very much for coming on the show, Rebecca.
Thank you for having me, Sarah.
Do you want to explain what an intuitive writer is, and how you found your way to that as a career?
Yeah, I feel that a lot of people who do actually more creative type of writing, or especially poetry, probably do a lot of that intuitively anyway. So for me, writing intuitively is not writing just from my mind and figuring things out that way and problem solving. It's a process of that's more free form. And where I just get a little bit quiet before I begin to write, and I start to, oftentimes I take something that's beautiful, maybe an image, of often something that's in nature, and I kind of gaze into it, and I start to hear or see messages. So, and they just come very quickly for me. So if it's poetry, then I may look at a rose, and I sit there for a moment, and I start to see images of the rose, or images of words, and or hear them, and they just start to come, and I don't even know what I'm writing, honestly, as it happens, and it comes through, and it's this free-form poem. and so that sometimes I do that for other people, and so I would just really try to presence their energy empathically to feel what message wants to come through for them. And so that's something that I've been able to do from, you know, pretty much for many, many, many years. And I was able to bring that into my career, particularly even with copywriting, which might seem strange because that's more of a technical way to write. But I've been able to, I don't do corporate copywriting, but I have niche clients who do a lot of empowerment work, or are creatives or artists and things that kind of flow in that realm that's much more heart-based and sort of soul-based. And so I'll fit and I'll feel into, you know, what does that message actually really want to be for them to serve their clients? And often it is a little more poetic as a result. And it's not as in your face salesy. It's more of inviting people to come and not feeling like you have to do a hard sell. And so, yeah, that's worked out really well. And the clients have been extremely successful and their businesses have grown, even though it's a very different way of, quote unquote selling.
And when did you first go into this sort of business? It's very intuitive, creative writing space.
When it actually really became quite my business itself was about 5 years ago or so. And that was on the back of, you know, some international moves and a divorce, and knowing really in my heart that I knew what I needed to be doing was to write and to share my voice in the world. And I wasn't going to give that up. And at the same time, I didn't want to sell myself out. I didn't want to, most people are not going to earn a living off of writing novels, or certainly as a poet, that's pretty rare. And I'm not a professor at a uni, so, nor a teacher. So I needed to find a way to merge things. So I started coaching, and then I was able to bring the words back in as a way to serve people too, and really just honor my voice. And then I feel like when you're clear about what it is that you're being asked to do in your life and what your kind of mission is in some way, that even if it doesn't make sense, but you follow that, doors start to open up. And that's what happened for me. I had opportunities to not follow my heart and to give up and to just do the normal 9-to-5 thing that most people would have advised me to do. And I felt really, I had these moments where I just felt really strongly in my heart, no, I need to just have a little bit of faith. And then suddenly an opportunity came up where a person who is a bit of an intuitive teacher of mine needed a copywriter. And it just fell into place. And in fact, she didn't even know she needed a copywriter. She thought she needed an assistant. And then when we started talking, she said, really what I need is somebody to write for me. And I've been with her for 5 years. And then her business has grown about 18 times the size. And that's opened doors for me to do a lot of writing for other people too in their businesses. And then support me to do more of my personal projects and what I want to do as well. So yeah, I think it came from just me trusting.
What sort of personal projects do you do?
So some of the personal projects are the poetry that I'll write in that very intuitive way. And that's really dear to my heart and brings a lot of joy to me. That's just purely just bliss and joy for me to write in that way. I love feeling kind of in that state that kind of otherness, that these words are just coming. And then afterwards I'm like, whoa, I didn't know I just wrote that. It's kind of fun. And then I also love to, some of my personal projects would be, again, some books, you know, that I might be collaborating with other people on, or doing some more of the coaching with people, and also writing workshops online or in person with people so that they can write intuitively as well. And I feel that's important because I feel it's really important for us as autistics as well, especially because for me, that intuitive writing piece is essentially it's just getting in touch with your own voice and what's really true for you instead of what society says. And in our world in general, whether we're neurotypical or not, that's a big issue where there's a lot of noise and people say, well, you have to do things this way, or you know, this is the way to do things, or this is how you have to think, or this is what's right and this is what's wrong. And it's so noisy, and it's hard to then filter all of that out and just trust ourselves and listen to what we're our own real knowing and wisdom is. And as autistics, you know, I feel like that noise can be even louder sometimes for us.
Yeah, no, definitely. And that's a really lovely segue into, you know, what I wanted to ask you about, because obviously you're working in an area that requires highly developed empathy skills and really being able to feel into yourself emotionally. And that's something that, you know, we're often criticized as autistic people for not being able to do. So I also, you know, heard some sort of typical things as well, such as, you know, you being self-employed and, or, you know, needing to express your own true self. So I was just wondering, you know, how does that work for you in your particular area, being autistic?
How does it work for me, you know, being...
Yeah, like, how do you feel that being autistic informs your work?
Oh, gosh. Oh, well, everything. everything, honestly. And in fact, I think it's my autism that allows me to do the intuitive work. I don't think there's any separation there. So I think mm-hmm. it's also my autism that has that heightened state of empathy. I think it's really funny when people say we're not empathic or have these skills of empathy. I think it's that actually we feel so much that sometimes we may shut those things down because it can be inundating. And so, and to feel so much going on, we may not quite grasp the thread of what it is, and it's too much. And sometimes we have to shut down, and sometimes we may need to shut down a lot if we don't know what all of that is that's going on. And so, or how to even manage it for ourselves. So I think, you know, yes, I work for myself, and that's a gift being, you know, my autism. It's wonderful to work for myself because I can control my schedule, and I'm a solo parent and so of an autistic child. And so I'm able to, you know, take her to school every day and be there for her and make sure, you know, she's going to her appointments as well. And I can manage this energy and take really loving care of myself and honor my autism in terms of, you know, if something, you know, maybe I can do two things a day outside my regular schedule. And beyond that, I know it's stretching me to be a bit much. And so I can schedule things that way. And I can schedule that in my business. I have a lot of autonomy and freedom. And that is a huge blessing. And I feel like my autism also, my clients often that I write for, they are really grateful because I am able to find a lot of structure in things that sometimes aren't super structured. I can find the patterns. When I'm doing copywriting for someone and they have a big story to tell, basically, that or sell, then even writing an about me page for their website or whatever, they don't really sometimes know how to hone in what the specific message really is. And I'm, you know, my autism's able to find all these patterns that weave together to find the core message of what's true and reflect that back to them. So that things are much more concise and we know what we're really talking about, and I can challenge them about that, honestly. And that's a lot of the work that I end up doing is far beyond copywriting or whatever. I'm using those autistic skills of pattern recognition, which is a lot of intuitive stuff, honestly, I think, with pattern recognition. And then feeling into the core, like the primary message of something, you know, you're like something's going through a sieve.
Yeah, stripping it down.
It's beautiful and fun. And I think something a lot of us could easily do, but I think it takes some intuition as well to kind of feel like this nebulous place of, well, what's true? And so then to do that for other people, but then also to do that for myself and my work. And our world is so fast that we don't often take the time to just slow down a little bit to feel that, to feel the quintessence of something.
Yeah, I remember you you said something on your website about seeing the poetry of life. excellent copy.
Yeah, I probably wrote that intuitively because I don't remember writing that. But it makes me smile because I'm like, oh, that's so sweet. But, oh, I wrote that. That's nice. I don't actually remember a lot of those things, but that's feeling into as my wish for so many of us is to see the beauty of what life offers, and that, in fact, I think, you know, that we are all poetry. But I was saying that I feel that we are actually poems and love poems, and we're walking around and when I kind of feel into that even more, I kind of sometimes feel like we're all music, and that might be why sometimes some of us don't mesh so well. Maybe the chords of our music as individual beings are sharp against one another instead of harmonious, and we will kind of walk around in this world like that. And I think together we create a lot of this music and harmony or disharmony, and we can do that within ourselves. And I think a lot of that comes from, again, that even, I think it takes a sense of belonging in some ways. It's this sense that we matter and we belong. And I know that can be a real hard part for a lot of us in our community. Feeling very different in the world, and often not feeling like we quite belong here. And so we attribute a lot of pain to that, whereas I feel when we can sense that we all have a part to play, and that's so important and beautiful, then it can make a difference.
And when did you realize that you were autistic?
Only a few years ago, and like a lot of other women who are older, it was after their child's diagnosis. So my daughter was about 9 and had self-diagnosed, and she was begging me to get her tested and evaluated, and I just ignored. I thought that was so silly. And then one day I thought, okay, I'll look this up, and I looked up the gender-based, you know, traits of, I didn't know to look up autism, really, being in the States. I looked up Asperger's, and then thought, well, all of the traits sounded like me. And then I think it's quite funny, because then I thought, well, then I don't have Asperger's, so there's no way. I'm not autistic, so there's no way that my daughter is, if I have all of these traits. And it was only, you know, it was a year and a half after her diagnosis that it clicked with me, like, oh, wait a minute, I might be autistic too. So, yeah, and it explained everything.
And I was just going to say, how did it change things
everything.
For you?
It actually helped me understand that I could write in this way, number one, because I do attribute it to my autism. Like this sensitivity of being able to feel things in different ways, and to feel them really strongly in my body and interpret them. And, you know, maybe even it's some synesthesia, I don't know, but it's in a different kind of way. But I can taste words sometimes, and I can feel them and see images. And so oh, that kind of explains things. And it explained, again, I could go back to the patterns of my life and understand the difficulties and the parts of not feeling like I belonged and felt different and even felt adopted, you know, from not even part of my family. And the times where, you know, I had maybe negatively things were being impacted, but I had no idea. Or there were times I thought, well, maybe I have chronic fatigue syndrome, but I think it's just me managing, you know, a very active nervous system. And so, you know, I just thought it was super intuive introverted and
Why did you think you had chronic fatigue
because
syndrome?
I'd get tired from, you know, going to the shops. You know, I would get, you know, like if I if I was pushing myself after going to and then the noises and things like that, sometimes it would wear me out and I'd go home, and after doing things, if I was pushed too hard, then I'd have to wrap up in a blanket and shut off the lights. Or I might be in a shop and it's busy and I could break out in a cold sweat. And then afterwards, when I was home, I'd hurt, like my body would hurt. And I would think, well, why is my, you know, body hurting? Maybe I have, why can't I, you know, and when I didn't work for myself and had a typical job, I felt sometimes I had to call in sick because I felt kind of sick. And I see this with my daughter as well. There's this generalized, it almost sort of feels like the flu, like achy body, but you're not really sick. It's more like your mind's tired and you just sort of can't focus. And for me, what I recognize in myself and my daughter is that it's sensory overload. And so things have just been, there's too much input going on. And if that's not managed, then it can make me feel kind of sick, or and then I can go into shutdown and things. So, so learning that so that I could manage that from the outset, say, oh, okay, well, what are my boundaries? What are my sensory boundaries? You know, I know that I can go out, you know, okay, it's best for me to try to go grocery shopping when it's off hours and not so many people are there. And, okay, I can take in noise-canceling headphones, or I go when I really, if I'm tired and already kind of stressed, don't go if I don't have to. Put it off until I feel like I have more energy, because otherwise that's going to zap me more. And kind of two things is my limit. And then beyond that, I can do it, but I know it will, I'll have more repercussions afterwards and things like that. So I can, or if I know I'm going to be in a place that's very noisy and lots of people, or, you know, a party or something, then I can, prior to that, I can rest and not schedule anything else that day going up to it, so that I'm really kind of at this very calm place, and then schedule time afterwards so that I'm kind of not doing anything again to kind of recover from it. Yeah.
You know, definitely. I went to a wedding yesterday and I have the day off today.
Exactly.
other than this. Just tying in what you just said there, you obviously wrote on the guest questionnaire that you thought that the worst thing about being autistic was the lack of acceptance of our divergence, and resulting in us living in a world that doesn't have many sensory safe spaces, which I think that you also, you know, described in much more detail just now. But I guess my question to you is, what does a sensory safe space look like?
It's hard to find them, you know, out in public, that's for sure. Unless it's in nature. But you can find them. To me, it's a place where there is much more quiet, and that there's not great big fluorescent lights, and you're not hearing, you know, doors with bells jingling on them when you walk in.
They are the worst.
Why? Why do you have these? Or, you know, when you put your chip in the reader to check out and it's beeping and yelling at you. And, you know, that if you're in a shop and things are really like closed in and close together, or loud music playing. So for me, it's about having more open spaces so that people aren't jumbled together and you're not pushed up against things, and there's a lot of natural light, and there's maybe some plants and some beauty, and it's quieter, and that there, even within that, there's spaces to go and sit, like little nooks that are quiet spaces, to go, if you need to stop and kind of reflect, or, you know, before going on and taking in. Sometimes some museums have areas that do a great job of that, and not all, but some do. And so I think, you know, so for me at home, there's, I try to create that space a lot. It becomes my sanctuary.
How does that... You know, this emphasis of you know, I think that we, autistic people, we generally all need time to go away and be quiet and not be disturbed at that particular time. How does that tie in with being a parent to, you know, children know no boundaries? How does that work for you?
You know, we're both very open about our autism, so we communicate about it. And so she knows, in fact, she's, well, so on one hand, when she knows very much my sensory sensitivities. And so she'll, there's even times where she'll say, no, you should go to this other shop first and get it done with, because if you go to the other one, it's busier and you won't even make it to the next one. You'll be done. And I'm like, you're right. And so there's that. So we have this really beautiful open dialogue about things, and she knows that, let's say I come home from something and I need 20, 30 minutes. She's, you know, she's 12 now, so she does understand it. But I think you could start that. I mean, she and I have been doing this for a very long time, even before either of our diagnoses. And so I would just say, I'm going in my room. I have to shut off the lights and don't come in. Give me 20 minutes. And she'll say, okay. So she knows. And she knows that if I don't get that, then I'm really frustrated and flustered and I'm stressed. And she doesn't want that. So it doesn't, she's smart and logical and knows it doesn't benefit her to have me and, you know, push myself more. Also, we had very interesting experience just the other week where I knew that I was going into shutdown, what they call autistic shutdown, and that I needed, you know, I was looking at booking a hotel room for myself because we have animals. I didn't even want to be around the animals. That I need to just be completely alone, but I am a solo parent. And so that can be challenging, but, she had been invited to have a sleepover at someone's house, which was crazy because that hadn't happened in a very long time. And so I managed to, you know, you have to be on for your children no matter what, but I was able to say, okay, I can do this until Saturday, and then I'm going to really honor myself and completely shut down and do whatever I need to do for myself. And I let family members and my partner who doesn't live here know that that was what was going to happen. And because she was out of the house and I was able to just completely shut down and do it in a really different way than I had in the past, which was like, sometimes I was just so like, it's going to come and I have no control over it. And then I'm like anxious and nervous about it and maybe not very happy. And this time I thought, no, I'm going to really... because like you said, I think all of us, it's part of our lived experience. We can't, I don't think any of us can avoid having those shutdowns. And I think they're actually really required for us to rejuvenate and in a beautiful way. And I was able to look at it from this different point of view this time. And it was really wonderful. And in fact, I didn't have to shut down as long as I had to in the past because I didn't resist it. And for me, I guess I keep repeating myself, but I really felt like it was a place of honoring my autistic experience and being an autistic person and saying, you know, this isn't a bad thing. This is actually really needed and beautiful and can help me kind of renew myself so I can come back and create more when I'm ready. But we need this space. Yeah.
It's very controlled what you're describing. Very much. No, I mean, like what you were saying, there's so many people who have things forced upon them. But by you saying no, you know, we're going to turn off the lights. And what is it that you do when you're in that space? You just
if it's like the small shutdowns, right? So it's just a daily sort of shutdown. But in terms of, you know, I need the 20 minutes after. I mean, honestly, every time if I have to go to a grocery store or whatever, I will come straight home and I'll, if it's been busy there, I'll come straight home and I'll go in my room. And so I shut off all the lights. I put on my noise canceling headphones and I wrap up in a blanket really tight, like a burrito. And I kind of rock a little bit. And that swaying really comforts me. That's my stimming. And maybe that's for about 20 minutes or so. And then I feel like much better. And then I'm slowly kind of come back out and don't take in a bombardment of things. And I'll do that if I know I'm going to have a meeting, for example, like a team meeting with my clients. And I know a lot of information is going to be coming and that's going to require my executive functioning. I have the luxury of working from home. So the 30 minutes before that meeting, I'm resting and I'm in my room and I'm wrapped up in a blanket and I'm stimming so that I can feel really calm and open-minded beforehand. And these bigger ones, I think the controlness comes from somewhat it was required because I'm a parent and I don't have a partner living with me. So I don't have someone that can back me up. So she's my number one priority. Always feel I have to. And again, I'd work from home. So maybe leading up to that shutdown, I wasn't doing very much work. And at home when she was at school, I was doing shutdowns a bit. But I knew I needed, 24 hours at least completely alone with no interruptions or responsibilities. And that meant she couldn't be home, you know, and that ended up working out. But I was trying to do what I could for myself leading up to that, but not resist it. I guess that's part of it is and a lot of it's self-awareness again of recognizing, oh, this is what's happening. And instead of,
yeah, you sound really successful at combining all of these things. You know, it can be so challenging, like just job, daughter, you know, single parenthood, that kind of thing. And then to put all of the sensory needs that you have as well and to make all of that work.
There's times it doesn't feel like it, that's for sure. But those are honestly times when I'm being pushed and I'm not listening to myself or I feel like I can't, you know, or if I feel like I have to meet these deadlines or whatever. Mm. But I think so much of it for me is being really honest with myself and being aware and also not being mad at my autism, you know, like having this, being at peace with it and saying, okay, this is what it is. And I know that these can be challenges, but not being angry. I know it might be kind of funny to say talk about my autism as something, this other thing, but I'm like, but it's part of me. And if I get mad at this autism part, then I'm being mad at myself. Like I'm internalizing that. And that's not good. Mm. And at least for me, I know I've noticed that if I get angry and frustrated about these traits that are challenging, then it's more stressful and more challenging because I'm actually hating part of myself, which is not, you know, I can't extrapolate it.
Yeah.
So why not embrace it and say, okay, and like actually honor that, yes, this is going to be a challenge, but how can I work with it?
Yeah, and I understand, you know, from your website and what you've written and what you said here today that self-expression and authenticity and freedom to be yourself is very important.
It really is,
to
because
you.
I feel like, at least for me, you know, it's part of being able to come to a place to fully express myself really came from my diagnosis, a large part, you know, where I finally was like, oh, I'm not going to hide these things because I'm very good at masking. I am very good. I'm like, yeah, I mean, I can,
oh, really?
I've done it my whole life. So many people would not know I'm autistic at all unless they lived with me, but I'm not going to hide that anymore. I don't feel like that serves our community. And it certainly doesn't serve me, and it doesn't serve my relationships with people. And so I felt this real liberation from my diagnosis for me to even understand myself and have this self-awareness. And then I thought, I'm not going to pretend anymore. And I'm going to talk about these things and I'm going to express myself fully. And because otherwise you feel kind of caged. And I also, that to me is mirrored with this, again, this place of not feeling quite like we belong. And so if we don't feel, the moment we feel like we don't belong or we quite fit in, we start shutting down our voices and we start masking a lot and we put so much energy into that, we can start to lose ourselves. I certainly did. And I'll be quite honest, and you know, and sadly, this is not going to be an unusual story, but you know, that even led to my attempted suicide at age 17. And now, with my diagnosis, I can see why all of that happened and my masking and things and thinking I needed to fit in a certain way. And I see this is so much what happens in our community. Suicide's a big issue. And that all comes from this place of not feeling that we have a voice and that we do belong. And so I am really passionate about it because I feel like it can, you know, honestly be our liberation and save our lives. And it can be absolutely deadly.
It can be deadly.
If we don't.
This is an unfortunately true fact that so many autistic people do try to unsuccessfully mask and hide who they are, and then it just gets a bit too much. You have since said several times about feeling like belonging to community and our community, and so I was just interested in knowing how you had found your autistic community. And in what ways?
Yeah,
you,
I found my autistic community online, and I so wish I had more of an autistic community in person. And I really, like, my heart really yearns for that, honestly. But yes, online, and it kind of originated with another woman who writes and is autistic, and we connected. And as she, you know, I had only just followed many of the self-advocates and advocates, but she created a little safe space where I was introduced to many of them. And so I started feeling much more of this sense of community and this place where we support one another and share with one another about advocacy work and just about being autistic. And that has, and I, you know, and from that, one of those advocates lived not too far from me. So we were able to meet up and have coffee and have this beautiful experience about, I think there's something beautiful about sitting with another autistic person in person, in person, and talking about your autism. And, you know, we were, you know, there's something so that we find ourselves in one another. And so there is that place where we can see, oh, we're not alone. And then we can express ourselves authentically, I find, with other autistics, because we get it. And we all have very different ways of expressing ourselves, of course, but there's this core, you know, a lot of people are talking about autistic culture. So there's something that, you know, holds us together. And then there's this innate kind of recognition and acceptance. And so
there is just a level of understanding that, yeah, just seems to go beyond anything the neurotypicals can give me. But as you said, autistic people do nonetheless experience their autism differently. And I'm just sort of looking at your list of publications, noticed that there's quite a lot about femininity in there. And you were talking earlier on about finding it harder to get diagnosed because of being a woman. I was just wondering if there was anything you wanted to say about how or why that was important to you.
Yeah, I mean, I am really passionate about you know, those who identify as female being missed and not diagnosed, misdiagnosed on the spectrum. You know, even that the systems of diagnosis are not set up in a way that are equal playing fields for genders. And my understanding is that many of us who identify as female will, we internalize maybe our autism more than boys. And so, like, perhaps our categorization of things may be more of people or things, or they're, you know, things that people think are gender appropriate. And they may be causes. And so for my daughter, it's animals and specifically dogs. And for me, it's writing, you know, it's writing, it's archetypes. It's looking into the, you know, self-awareness stuff. I mean, my special interest has been spirituality and, you know, self-awareness and self-help stuff like for years. So like, but I think that's probably true for a lot of us that we, are really, and we probably all quite know ourselves really well, not all of us, but I think a lot of us probably know ourselves quite well because we are investigators. And I just, after coming out with my diagnosis and just sharing a little bit of information about females and autism, I've had some friends get official diagnosis, of their autism. I've had some friends that have self-diagnosed as a result. And I really just would love to see so many more people, especially females, receive a diagnosis or self-identify, because I do really believe that this gives us a whole new framework and lens on which to experience and see our lives so that it makes sense. And also then find community. And I've just heard so many people say that this was kind of the beginning of their lives once they received their diagnosis. Everything started to click together. So I wish that very much for girls and women, you know, and those who identify that way.
Yeah, it's quite the light bulb moment, isn't it? Your friends who you said were subsequently inspired to get diagnoses of their own, were they
and so that was really interesting. And I'm always interested when someone says they want to learn a little more, because there's not a lot of people who want to learn more. And it's kind of a little tip off for me that if they're curious and they're somehow seeing themselves in some of it, it could be really likely they're on the spectrum. because they may not have any interest otherwise because it wouldn't really resonate with them, and, you know, unless they have a family member who's autistic or something. But yes, some of them were, and then a couple of people, well, one of them was actually my childhood friend that is still one of my very best friends, and we had this bond that was very different from any of my other friendships, and it's probably because now we both can kind of understand probably our autism, our shared autism, that created this bond that's lasted, you know, I'm 45, you know, so from when we were in third grade on, and we understand each other in this way and communicate with each other. We kind of quote unquote geek out on basically our special interests, is what we now understand what we've done our whole lives together, but didn't know. And so I can see why our relationship was so special. And so it's kind of beautiful to see that. And another person was even someone I dated, but had this very strong, we had this very, very strong bond many years ago too. And we've been able to say, you know, we think it's our shared autism, that there was this intensity, and kind of deep understanding and knowing of one another that we couldn't ever quite put to words.
It just worked. Very much been my experience as well. You go through life with friends, and then you realize that you're autistic, and then you realize that, hang on, quite a lot of the people around me are as well. And I just thought we
I think
friends.
It's really funny how it's easy to start picking people out. I feel like I could diagnose a lot of people. And I think part of that's because, you know, I don't think how we diagnose people is really that great anyway. It's all deficit based. So if we could have diagnosis criteria based on strengths, I think we'd also find a lot more people being diagnosed. So.
No, I think you're quite right. The standard adult Asperger's assessment. I was having someone use that this week, and it just didn't work. She identified as a woman, and a lot of the answers, she was just like, "What on earth is this? Like, why would I collect number plates?" And I was like, "Fair." So yeah, you definitely need something of an overhaul by way of confirming who we are, because I think that we're quite good at recognizing it, but that form of external validation could really do with a bit of an overhaul.
Very much. Maybe if they talk to autistic people, maybe they would and included them on what an evaluation would look like, maybe things would change. I don't know. Just a thought.
Yeah, definitely. Talk to autistic people and then listened to the answer. Okay. Do you want to tell me a bit more about your general writing work and what it is that you offer to other people? I know you said that you do online writing circles, and
okay.
I'm just asking if you want to give your pitch,
so
as it were.
For me, basically, as you've stated, kind of my core belief is I want to help people express themselves authentically, and I feel like when we do that, then we are really rooted in belonging here and knowing we're all interconnected, and from that place we can really share our voices even and amplify them even more in the world. And so I help people do that in a few different ways, and so one is through professional writing services like copywriting and intuitive copywriting and coaching around their writings. And then I also do like to work, you know, kind of serve people in a different kind of way. So that might mean somebody says, oh, they might want a personalized intuitive poem. And so I will write them for them and feel into them empathically and write them a poem. And then another way that I'd serve people through writing is with these writing circles. And so, again, we practice learning together. Practice together, which I've never had anyone not be able to do it. It's super easy. Just we just use mindfulness practices basically, and like a little bit of a meditative journey, and people feel into themselves, and I give them a writing prompt, and then they write these most beautiful, gorgeous things. Even people who hate writing and don't think they can write, write the most amazing, amazing things from their heart that serves, I think, as medicine. And helps us on our journey and become clear about things and who we are and maybe what we're up to. And so I love doing that. And I've done those with grief therapy groups in the past. And I've done them with teen girls who I feel like, you know, they're this group of people who are really primed to not be sharing their voice in the world and to shut it down. And I think that can be dangerous. So I work with them or just women and men. And I do a lot of those online now, but I also like doing them in person. And
And where is it that you live, Rebecca?
I live in the U.S. and I in Washington State. So, yeah. So
Washington State, cool. So just in case any of our listeners happen to be in Washington State, they can look you up.
Yep, I'm there, but I do a lot of my work online too, so it doesn't really matter where anyone is. So, yeah. But I would love if there's people in the Pacific Northwest and they wanted to connect. You know, I'm happy to meet up for coffee or whatever, so that would be fun.
For quite a long time, and there was just one small point that I wanted to raise, which was that you mentioned earlier that you can taste words. Does that mean that you have synesthesia?
I don't know. I'm wondering if I do too. sometimes I can taste them. Sometimes I feel them. Like I can feel them in my body. I don't know if with synesthesia, it's like it has to be the same thing each time, but like I can't say that one word tastes a certain way all the time. It's not that. It's just that sometimes, especially when I'm in that more kind of flowy state, then you know, some words will feel and sound and taste sort of metallic to me or tinny, or and I'll feel them in my body, and I can see images sometimes with words, and then things kind of flow together, and I interpret them in that way. And so maybe I do. I don't think I know about it enough, but it makes me sort of wonder.
Interesting. Okay, well, I think that's really everything I wanted to ask you. Fascinating. I'm so glad that you got in touch with us a few months ago on our Instagram, and I took the opportunity to look you up. How would you like people to get in contact with you if they wanted to follow up anything that you've mentioned on this episode?
You can do that a few different ways. You can go to my website, and there's a contact section, and you can fill that out, and that goes and come straight to me as an email. You can find me on Instagram and with my name. And you could also, I have a business Facebook page, so with my name, Rebecca Cavender, and so you can find me there as well. So any of those places, you're welcome to reach out.
Fantastic. And we will have links to all of those on our blog post for this episode at audibleautism.com.
Okay.
So thank you so much for coming on, Rebecca. This was absolutely fantastic. I wish you the best of luck with your service to others, I think is probably the best way of putting it.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much. Thank you
for having me. Yep. I really appreciate it. Okay.
If you'd like to stay in touch with us, you can check out our website at www.audibleautism.com for links to things discussed in the episode and for our back archive. You can subscribe to us on most podcast distribution platforms, including iTunes. Just search for Audible Autism. This podcast is part of a larger project the Autistic Empire, which is aiming to create an autistic community centered around our interests as autistic people. You can check us out at www.autisticempire.com. We post all of Audible Autism's episodes to our Autistic Empire channel, so you can like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter and Instagram, and we're even on Pinterest. Just search Autistic Empire to receive news and updates. We also have a forum where enrolled citizens can discuss the latest episodes and other issues of interest to autistic people, so do check that out as well. If you have any questions or would like to get in touch with us to be on a future episode of Audible Autism, you can always email us at team@audibleautism.com. Thank you for listening.